So our committee chair, Bill Staples, could not make it today. I'm Rob Fitz. I'll be stepping in. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the Asian Baseball Committee's first research project that we've ever had. We are producing a two-volume Sabre publication on the tours of Japan. Since 1906, there have been over 100 tours of Japan from teams from North America or Hawaii. And our two-volume set will focus on about 60 of these tours, all of the professional tours to go over, and about a dozen of the college, amateur, and semi-pro tours, the most important ones. The chapters are detailed, in depth. They go from 5,000 words to 10,000 words. They provide statistics when available for the tours. And this is the first time in English this information will be published. And the first volume, this chapter, should come out in November or December of this year in time for the end of the 150th anniversary of Japanese baseball. Second volume will come out in 2023. So, since Bill's not here to tell you about the newsletter and business of the committee, what I thought I'd do instead is give you a little taste of what's in these volumes. We have two presentations today. I'll talk about the 1956 Brooklyn Dodgers tour of Japan. Adam Birnbach will talk about the 1920 All-American tour of Japan. And these are informal presentations. We'll basically, I'll be talking about through slides rather than present a written paper or anything like that. But before I begin, since we have plenty of time, are there any questions about the committee or about this upcoming two-volume set? Okay. All right, so as I said, we're going to talk about the 1956 Brooklyn Dodgers tour of Japan today. So on October 11th, 1956, the Brooklyn Dodgers trudged into Idlewild Airport in Jamaica, Queens. And the night before, they had just lost the seventh game of the World Series to the New York Yankees. As most of you remember, the GOAT of the series was Don Newcombe, who had just finished one of the more remarkable pitching seasons during the 1950s. Buddy got knocked out in Game 2, and right after the game, punched the parking attendant in frustration. And then he got knocked out quickly in Game 7. And as he leaves the ballpark after Game 7, he starts yelling at Dodger attendants, "I'm not going to Japan. I hate this team. I'm gone. You'll never see me again." And he goes into hiding that night. And that's a whole other story we'll have to get into some other time. But the next morning, the Dodgers get on the airplane, and there's no Don Newcombe. Finally, after they've all taken their seats, Don Newcombe shows up, walks to the airplane. His wife is not accompanying him, and she was supposed to go on the tour. He has no suitcase, but he yells, "The Tiger is here," and sits down. So we have a very tense flight there. First, they're going to Los Angeles and spending the night there. They've just lost, as mentioned, and the team ain't too happy. So Peter O'Malley decides to liven things up by painting a face on the young Vin Scully as he slept. So after a quick stop in Los Angeles, we go to Hawaii for a few days where the players had a ball. They had a luau and they hung out on the beach. And they also played three baseball games. And these were against semi-pro Hawaiian teams, which were good teams, but they were no match for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Until Game 3, when Don Newcombe pitched. And Newcombe only lasted four innings. And after the game, when he left at four innings, losing to the semi-pro team, the fans basically had lost their temper, and they were booing and jeering him. After the game, he says, "I can't believe I'm still the target for abuse after getting 5,000 miles away from Brooklyn. I never want to come back here again. I didn't want to make this trip in the first place." And then he series up. He says, this abuse thing is beginning to worry me. I'm afraid the emotional effect might continue to grow and become detrimental to my future career. So the team goes off to Japan. And kind of as a harbinger of things to come, the plane breaks down in Wake Island. And they end up spending hours on the tarmac, and their players are exhausted. Now, as you probably know, this is not the first team to come to Japan after World War II. And look at the records. Put special note to the records I have down here. So we have the San Francisco Seals. We have the Joe DiMaggio Left Field All-Stars in 1951. In 1953, we have the Eddie Lopat All-Stars with Eddie Matthews, Robin Roberts, and Yogi Berra. Notice all these teams have only lost one game. We also have the New York Giants, who were there at the same time as the Eddie Lopat All-Stars. And in 1955, we have the New York Yankees, which went undefeated. So the Dodgers show up about 6 or 7 hours late. It's raining in Tokyo, and everybody's kind of miserable. But they're welcomed at the airport with a great ceremony that took an hour or so, and the press conference. And these exhausted players wanted nothing better than to go to the hotel and sleep. But no, they had to go to a reception with the Omiri Giants, where they're given their hoppy coats and their headbands known as hachimaki. And it was a party that lasted hours. For many of them, it was the first time they had ever seen or eaten Japanese food. And even though they were exhausted, almost all the players said, yeah, they actually had a pretty good time. The next morning, or next afternoon, they start with playing right away with an opening game against the Omiri Giants, filled with ceremony, as you can imagine. Did a lot of photographs on it. And to everybody's surprise, the Omiri Giants beat them. And notice down in the lower headline, the Dodgers struck out 16 times during this game. Next game, the Dodgers bounce back. Quick win. But the third game was perhaps one of the most looked forward to because Don Newcomb was pitching. And the Japanese have always really been up on American baseball. There are a multitude of weekly baseball magazines covers the major leagues. That's detailed articles on the players. They knew who Don Newcomb was. They knew how great season he was, and they really wanted to see the ace Dodger pitch. The first batter he faced was Wally Onamine. And of course, Wally was a Hawaiian-American, played for the San Francisco 49ers, professional football, played in the minor leagues before becoming the first major American to play in Japan after World War II. And while he works out Don Newcomb for a walk, the next batter hits a home run. And then the next three batters get singles. And Don Newcomb is pulled after 17 pitches. They say he stumbled off the mound like a sleepwalking person, went right into the clubhouse, did not shower, did not change, walked out the back door, jumped into a taxi, and went back to the hotel by himself. After the game, Pee Wee Reese says, he's still got the World Series on his mind. It's getting to be a terrible thing. Not only does he feel that he's letting himself down, he feels he's letting the club down. Don doesn't say much, but it's building up and building up inside of him. It could run him out of baseball. And if you know anything about Don Newcomb, this is prophetic. This is Don Newcomb's last good season. He's an alcoholic, but during Japan, his drinking takes over. Don Newcomb was afraid of flying, and the Dodgers flew from city to city in Japan. And he would really hit the bottle every time he flew, and he was very upset with his performance. And he really never had a good season afterwards, a couple of okay seasons. He finished his career in 1962 in Japan. And his coach, right next to him, number 37, is none other than Wally Onamine. So, with two losses, and if you remember back, No other professional team had lost twice in Japan. They're the first ones to lose. The Japanese are not particularly happy. Instead of being thrilled that their hometown teams are beating the Dodgers, they feel cheated because they expect the Dodgers to be one of the two best teams in the world, and they feel that they shouldn't be allowed to beat them. So, Walter O'Malley is particularly upset. Assuming I can get this to work, we'll hear Carl Erskine describe what happened next. It'll take me just a second to get this going because I'm not a PC person. Or longer than a second.
That we lost again. Mm-hmm. And Mr. O'Malley was really upset. And so he had a team meeting. And here's the essence of what he said. I want you boys to sign autographs. I want you to be cordial. I want you to be gentlemen. I want you to give this a goodwill trip and a good name. But boys, when you put on that Dodger uniform, I want you to remember Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, you said things like that back then.
Lost again.
All right, now I'll get to the next slide, so just hold on to a second. All right. Well, they won that game. Erskine pitched a shutout, Snyder hit a home run, but they only won by 1-0, and that did nothing to stop the criticism. Then the Japanese All-Stars tied the Dodgers. So now they're looking at one win, three losses? No, good, doing one. Thank you so much. Not good. And people started really looking at the Dodgers closely. Jackie Robinson and Pee Wee Reese are in their upper 30s. Most of their starters are in their mid-30s. And the Japanese are saying, you know what? I think this is it for the Dodgers. And they may have been the first one to really realize that this was the end. Well, Walter Alston also figured this out. And he had a lot of really young, untried players along with him. So he decided to start mixing up the lineup. And the Dodger stars would maybe start the game and be pulled right away, or they'd come in later just for an appearance. And instead, he started to rely on Don Drysdale, Don Demeter, Fred Kipp, and Jim Gentile. And lo and behold, they start to win, and win a lot and easily. Now, with Jim Gentile playing first base, Gil Hodges is stuck in the outfield, and Gil Hodges is bored silly. And I understand that he was a very quiet person, but in Japan, he decided to have some fun, and he started pantomiming the play that was on the field as he sat in the outfield. And the Japanese just adored this, and he soon became the most popular player on the Dodgers. And here we have a stage photo where he's sitting on the wall pretending to make a great catch. And after the photo, he stays up there and signs for autographs for everybody in the crowd. With the team winning, they resumed their goodwill function, signing autographs. I mean, they signed tens of thousands of autographs that trip. They became tourists, saw all the cultural sites, indulged in some of the traditions of Japan, hot baths, met local celebrities, did a lot of shopping, pearl shopping, and cameras were really big in the 1950s. And Jackie Robinson even had time to give a talk at the International School in Tokyo, where he talked about race relations and the eventual integration of U.S. schools. And this was a pretty big deal because this is a baseball tour. And so to get out there and start making political statements like that, it was a pretty big deal. And Japanese thought this was great. And they visited Hiroshima. In Hiroshima, they dedicated the game to the victims, and they presented the Hiroshima Carp with this plaque, which stood outside the stadium until very recently. And it was a very meaningful game for all the players, and it was a very tense game. And actually, it was a close game. And Temple was were started to overheat. And Jackie Robinson objected to a call by Jocko Conlon and just kind of got out of control. And Conlon had to toss Jackie Robinson in the middle of a goodwill game in Hiroshima. And that made news all over the states. Certainly after, soon after Hiroshima, the Japanese lose, the Dodgers lose their third game and then their fourth game in Japan. And now the criticism is coming pretty strong. Yamauchi here, one of the star Japanese players, said Dodgers are basically kind of lazy and they're not hustling. And he said this to the press, which most of the Japanese players would not do, but he came out and said that the Yankees always tried to take another base on us, always tried to rub us in the dirt. And the Dodgers will take their base and just stand there. And they're not hustling, and this isn't right, they're not that good. So, this I'm going to read for a little bit. So the Dodgers coach, Al Campanis, staged several clinics for the Japanese players. And he told the Sporting News, "For the good of Japanese ball, it would be well to send several American coaching staffs for the purchase of staging clinics rather than having a different team visit each year. We held one clinic, and while we were over there, and I never had a more attentive audience. They want to learn our methods, and a few clinics would help them tremendously." But during a roundtable interview in Japanese, several of the Japanese players bristled when asked about the clinic. "We attended it, but we already knew how to throw a slider," said Tetsuharu Kawakami. "They only told us what we already knew. I think we practice small tactics more than they do." Underwhelmed by the Dodgers, some of the Japanese players began to jeer their opponents. Now, the Dodgers were undoubtedly unaware of this because the rudeness consisted of calling the Dodgers by their first names. That was highly offensive. It still is not cool in Japan, but back in the 50s, you just would not do this. So the players confessed this during the roundtable interview. I'm going to read a translation. So Toyota, looking at Kawakami, says, "Remember you jeered at Newcomb in Mito? Something like, 'Come on, Don.' He was offended by that." Kaneda says, "We became good at jeering. Our pronunciation became better." Besho, looking at Kaneda, says, "You were the best at it. You called the first baseman cannoli, 'Gino, Gino,' and he turned and smiled at you. When the game was over, you were like, 'Goodbye, Gino.'" Kaneda goes, "Come on, Don. That was a good one." The moderator says, "Did you jeer at the other major league teams, like the Yankees?" And Kaneda's like, "Oh, no, we only did it this year." Besho says, "That's because we were winning." Kaneda finishes, "All right, I will say, 'Hi, Don,' to his face. And if he gets angry, I will hide quickly." Fans, however, loved the bums and didn't mind that they were losing. Hundreds of thousands of fans came out to the ballparks, followed them everywhere they went in the big cities, listened to them on the radio, watched them on TV. They were on the cover of magazines, newspapers. So the tour itself was a huge success despite the record. Final game was played on November 13th in Fukuoka. 19-year-old Kazuhisa Inoue takes the mound. He's one of the greatest pitchers in Japanese history. He's a rookie here. Fred Kipp takes the mound. They pitch, I think it was 8 shutout innings. And then it becomes 1-1. Top of the 9th, Snyder's on 3rd, and Jackie Robinson comes up for the last time in his career. He hits a single between shortstop and third, scoring Snyder, and a later comes around to score another run. And there is Jackie Robinson's last box score. Dodgers head home right after the tour. Right after that final game, I'm sorry. And as you know, they're not home long before Jackie Robinson is traded to the New York Giants, retires, and it's the end of the Brooklyn dynasty. But even though the Japanese tour marked the end of the Brooklyn dynasty, it was really the beginning of the Dodgers' interest in international baseball. And I would think really the beginning of true international baseball, period. The next spring, the Dodgers invited two young Japanese players and the Omiya Giants manager to spring training. And they started a 50-60 year tight relations with Japan, and especially the Omiya Giants. The Omiya Giants came to Vera Beach, I think, about five times up until about 1980. Dodgers went back to Japan in 66 and 1993. And, of course, they had the inside track to Hideo Nomo. So, like I said, it will be brief. That's a quick overview of the Brooklyn Dodgers tour of Japan. And I have about 3 minutes, if there's any questions on my talk, before we turn it over to Adam.
Okay. Why did they take the plaque away in Hiroshima?
I think they're rebuilding the stadium.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they did, actually, because I was there a couple of years ago, and I saw the site of the old stadium. I think the plaque was still there. I didn't take a picture. And then I saw a game that night in the new stadium, so, yeah.
Were the umpiring squads mixed, Japanese and American?
That's a great question. Yes, but Jack O'Connell was the main umpire, and then he would have some help with the Japanese, yeah.
What was the source of the Erskine audio clip? Because I know he's
still alive. So. He's a wonderful guy. I just got his email and said, can I talk to you on the telephone? And he's like, of course. And the next day I'm talking to him. Yeah, he's amazing. Yeah. Do I see someone back there? No. All right. So now... So now, Adam is going to come up and give his presentation.
Hey, as Rob said, I'm Adam Barenbach. I wrote two chapters in the book that Rob talked about, one on the 1922 tour and one on the 1958 tour of the St. Louis Cardinals. So today I'm going to be talking about the 22 tour, and as it is the 150th anniversary of Japanese baseball, it is also the 100th anniversary of the 22 tour. So, 100 years ago today, August 20th, 1922, Babe Ruth, of course born just down the street here, hit two home runs with nine total bases, a highlight of an otherwise lackluster season, marred in part by his suspension, handed down from Judge Landis because of flaunting barnstorming rules. On August 20th, 1922, in Kansas City, the Monarchs were playing a four-game series against the Cuban Stars in hopes of replacing Rube Foster's Chicago American Giants at the top of the Negro National League. And on August 20th, 1922, in Highlands, New Jersey, Herb Hunter, who had just retired as a ball player after a short stint with the Little Rock Travelers, was in the midst of finishing or putting on the final touches of a tour of Japan. And similar to Jackie's last box score, I was able to track down Herb Hunter's last box score and the article accompanying his retirement. I think he's actually wearing a Traveler's jersey in that picture. It's hard to see, though. So, 1922, a century ago. Japan was in the 11th year of the Taisho era. Just pulled his military out of Siberia. He was in the midst of an economic swing due to fluctuations in the silk market. He was the subject of racially motivated policies directed from both the League of Nations and the U.S. In 1922, Judy Garland was born. Hiroshi Yoshita was born. Takahisa Besho, who we saw earlier in those photos, was born in Minnie Minosa. Einstein fled Germany. As high inflation inflamed intolerance in the country, and the U.S., the fight for Native American rights began in earnest. Alexander Graham Bell died, the Eastern Color League was formed, and in Tokyo, Iso Abe's Waseda 9 faced the Kurizawa Summer Residents Association Baseball Club in preparation for their upcoming contest against the visiting U.S. major leaguers. In Italy, Mussolini and the fascists marched on Rome at about the same time as Herb Hunter and his U.S. All-American All-Star team were arriving in Japan seeking more to bridge the gap. So the tour that followed is best introduced by examining the two men most responsible for it taking shape. So Professor Iso Abe is sometimes referred to as the father of Japanese baseball, or sometimes the father of Japanese student baseball. After organizing the first baseball team at Waseda, he arranged for the first tour of a traveling collegiate team to the U.S. in 1905. And since then, Abe's Waseda 9 had faced U.S. competition on both sides of the Pacific at least a dozen times. He was determined to act as an ambassador for international baseball, a role that I believe influenced Hunter, as well as use his position to raise Waseda's status in Japan and the world. Herb Hunter had met Abe during the 1920 Gene Doyle tour of Japan, and when that tour had faltered, ended up working as a coach for both Waseda and Keio University. Hunter, who had played only 39 games over four seasons in the majors, was an eccentric, called a dandy by many, and regularly changed out the chrysanthemums in his lapel. He loved the attention and adoration of the students that he coached, of the Japanese public and the press, and he absolutely loved the nightlife there. A born self-promoter, he saw a chance to capitalize on that major league fame, to bring Babe Ruth to Japan, something that the baseball-loving public there had already been craving, even in late 1921 and 1922, and succeed where the Doyle tour had failed, and in the process, secure much-needed income, which is always important, satisfy his need to be worshipped, and like Abe, become an ambassador for the game and a man of consequence on the world stage. So with the approval of Ban Johnson and Judge Landis, who would come to later regret the decision, Hunter assembled a team featuring High Pockets Kelly, Casey Stengel, and Irish Musial from the Giants, Wade Hoyt, Fred Hoffman, and Joe Bush from the Yankees, and several others, including his old teammate Doc LeVon from the Cardinals. In the end, he could not secure Ruth, in part, I think, because of some reticence to barnstorm after his suspension. But Kelly, the home run champ and World Series hero, was nearly as desirable of a draw. So there had been talk of assembling a kind of all-star team as well of collegiate and club players in Japan. But in the end, the Hunter Troop faced teams from Waseda, Keio, and Meiji universities, as well as club teams such as Tomon, Diamond, and the Mita Club. These teams featured the top baseball talent in Japan, including future Hall of Famers Goro Taniguchi and Michimaro Ono. Taniguchi was Waseda's ace, who would go on to coach some of those Giants teams in the 50s. And Michimaro Ono would beat the U.S. team as the ace of the Mita Club. It was a game that was not only the first victory of a Japanese team over a visiting U.S. pro team, but the controversy of the tour, framed by the sometimes racist perceptions in the press as either a humiliation or a throne game, and one that may have influenced Landis' view of future tours. Both of these pitchers would continue to excel in international competition, including the 1927 Royal Giants Tour of Japan. Also featured were Abe's coach, Hall of Famer Chujun Tobita, a fierce competitor and a fanatic conditioner who was the creator of what some have called death training, Shinji Hamazaki, who would go on to pitch in the pro leagues until he was nearly 50, and would also be a member of the 31 and 34 All-Star teams that faced the U.S. traveling All-Stars, and Kazuo Tanaka, the premier slugger of the 1920s, sometimes known as as Babe Ruth Tanaka. So I think I'm doing well on time. So what I'm going to do is, I was going to go into the games in detail, but I figured you can buy the book, and there's much better written descriptions there. So I'm going to read two contemporary accounts of one game in Tokyo at the Shibo Grounds, and then one game in Hawaii. The team went 16-1, following the same track of, as Rob was demonstrating, the kind of one loss, with the exception of the Dodgers, and that one loss being the Mita game. What I'm going to describe right now is from the second game of that tour, versus Waseda University. It's from November 5th, 1922. A crowd that approximated 12,000 howled with glee at the Shibaro Diamond Sunday afternoon as the crack Waseda team, the pride of Tokyo, scored against the All-American Major League players and held that aggregation to the low score of 4-1. Waseda played a great game, but the play of the Americans, especially at the bat, savored of the big league style only in streaks. The pitching of Taniguchi, the Waseda moundsman, was easily the outstanding feature of the game. The Japanese southpaw gave a courageous and heady exhibition of hurling, holding the American sluggers to 8 hits, well scattered. His fast one was breaking nicely, causing the Americans to hit them up in the air for easy catches in the outfield. Bullet Joe Bush was on the mound for the Americans, and the Yankee star handed Waseda 6 singles by floating his slow ball down the alley to be pounded. Sewell showed himself to be a catcher whose future will be bright, but Sunday, he was unable to hold Bush's speed, the speed that made him the most effective pitcher in the American League. Moriarty, and I'll just take a break here, Moriarty was the umpire who went along with the team, and similar to the later tours, was the main umpire, but also was supported by local Japanese umpires. He was also the eyes and ears of Landis when he was there. Moriarty further handicapped the American pitcher by giving him none of those corners. In the 2 opening innings, only 6 Waseda men went to bat. But in the 3rd, a walk, 2 errors, and a hit enabled them to tie the score 1-1, where it stayed until the Americans went to bat in the following inning. With 1 down in the 3rd, Bush walked Umekawa. Hota was safe at first when Griffith muffed the grounder and Umekawa went to 2nd. Oshita struck out, but Kubota landed on the ball for a pretty single into right field. Falk could only have held Umekawa at 3rd, but he let the ball get away from him. Umekawa scoring amid an uproar from the bleachers. Hota went to 3rd and Kubota 2nd. Matsumoto ended the inning when he was out at 1st to Kelly, unassisted. And now the 2nd description. So after playing those games in Japan, the team traveled to Korea and played a few games in Manila, before finally going back to Hawaii, where they played several games against local competition there. This is from an article in the Hawaiian paper, but this is from when the team took a break to travel to the grave of Alexander Cartwright, which became, at least for a short period on some of the tours, a tradition to lay a wreath at his grave, and then they went and played this game. So this is by a guy named Doc Adams, League defeated Wanderers 6-1. Yesterday afternoon, the Wanderers went on record as being the best ball club in the islands at the present writing. A lot of us have suspected this for some time. Of the 3 pitchers sent in yesterday by the Hunter Club, Bullet Joe Bush was the boy demon. He sizzled him across the pan so fast that the boys didn't get much chance to make sure they saw it. They didn't get a hit off his delivery. They tapped Wade Hoyt for 5, however, and got into Penix's work for 2 more. The All-Americans got 8 hits and 6 runs off Johnny Williams, and John was forced to retire because his whip, which had been hibernating all winter, was getting chumpy. That peerless model for the Stetson Hat Company ads, Boob South, went to the mound for the Wanderers and proceeded to let the big leaguers down with 2 hits in 4 innings at one time. The big sensation of the game from the local standpoint was not the work for the visitors, but the fact that one of the home teams was able to shove a man over the rubber. So another interesting part that I discovered while doing research for this talk was that apparently a film was made of the tour. So from what I could glean from the sources that I found, this film follows the U.S. major leaguers across the Pacific on board the Empress of Canada in the Imperial Hotel and as they faced the talent in Japan. But it also was interspliced scenes of a melodrama. Before what is described as the championship game, High Pockets Kelly is kidnapped by the plotters when he refuses to take a bribe to throw the game. However, he manages to break his restraints, escape in time to get back to the ballpark, and get a hit that wins the game. And there's also a love story thrown in. The rest of the details are not as apparent. My guess is that they combine elements gleaned from the recent Black Sox scandal, as well as what doubtless must have been somewhat racist caricatures of dark or oriental bad guys so commonplace in U.S. popular culture at the time. And in addition to Japanese ballplayers portraying themselves, several professional actors accompanied the production. Most notably, Thomas Kisibora Kurihara, who is known for the Pure Film movement. The film was directed by American Ollie Sellers and shot by R.E.A. Irish, who sold his L.A. home just before leaving. I think that's his notice in the Los Angeles Times, selling his home on his way to Japan to film this melodrama. One blurb claimed that the film had been slated to be released in the U.S. as well as, quote, the Far East. So I searched Japanese and Hawaiian newspapers for the year after the tourists returned, but found no notice or listing of the film at all. There's no IMDb page, there's no internet presence, nor any reference in any baseball film indexes. So what happened to it? So I reached out to colleagues at the Library of Congress and the Japanese Diet, and no one was able to confirm that the film was ever released. But through sources they shared, I was able to piece together a little bit of this puzzle. So an obscure article turned up the name Harry Owens as producing this film. Owens had worked at the Thomas Ince Studios in L.A., one of the early studios to turn out silent era dramas. Ince had also created the quote-unquote Oriental Production Company that had trained the aforementioned Kurihara and others. Owens left the Ince Studio in May in 1921 to represent Associated Producers in Tokyo and head up the United Oriental Pictures Company, which appears to have been involved in both producing and distributing U.S. and Japanese films. Sellers, Irish, and the American actors seem to have possibly been at the Polo Grounds, but what is definitely certain is that they sailed separately from the tourists and stopped in Honolulu to shoot some establishing scenes with the actors. Scenes were filmed also of the games in Tokyo, as well as the dramatic shots with the American and Japanese actors, so that much we know. The Honolulu Advertiser reported in January of 1923 that Owens was headed back to New York with a, quote, melodramatic motion picture of intrigue, which would be released in New York in about a month. He was traveling with his wife, as well as Irish and one T. Sasaki, who apparently ran half the theaters in Tokyo. The last mention of the film is in a publication called Moving Pictures World, March of 1923, and it states that the film, still untitled, would be released around spring training, accompanied by a very large PR campaign. And that, like I said, is the last mention of it. It states that this would happen after distribution details were negotiated. So was the distribution deal squashed? Did Judge Landis was apparently, had apparently approved this project, and did he have something to do with it? Owens next appears, let's see, do I have another slide? Owens next appears in the press in June, announcing that he is leaving the film industry. So this is only a few months after this large PR campaign was supposed to happen, leaving the film industry for the real estate industry. He worked on and off in Hollywood until his death a decade later. So at this point, still looking for the film. Anybody ever wants to pick up some research and let me know if they find anything interesting, please. My email address is right there, and of course, any other questions. But that's all I've got today. So, if anybody has questions for me, please. Hi.
When you talked about the accusations that the game was thrown, were there evidence of that, or was it just sort of the assumption that the Americans would lose?
Similar to when the Dodgers and the Japanese teams were complaining that they were upset less about winning the game than having, you know, hardy competition. It was a combination of the press in Japan suggesting that such a loss couldn't happen. It was impossible to happen, so they must have thrown the game. And of course, like I said, this is kind of the Black Sox are fresh in everybody's mind. And then other members of the press in Japan and in the U.S. suggested that it had been a token, a gift, which of course was described in the Japanese press as very upsetting. This could be the worst insult that the team would give this gift to the local players. And then others suggested that it was simply done to drum up publicity, that with this loss they would get more people to turn out and the gate receipts would go up. All in all, that combined to create all these different stories, but in terms of any actual evidence, it's all conjecture. Hi.
Have you contacted the folks at the Eastman House to see what they may know about?
No, I have not.
They have incredible resources and collection.
That's a good idea. I'm going to do that tomorrow.
Do you happen to know roughly when the Goodwill tours stopped? I mean, around the time of the wars?
Well, that's, and you know, once again, I'll put the plug in for the book because it'll cover the whole span of that time period. But so after this tour, Hunter wanted to have tours annually. He, you know, like I said, he sort of saw himself as, you know, emerging as this ambassador on the world stage and having these annual tours. The following year, in 1923, there was a huge earthquake in Japan, the Great Kanto earthquake, which was devastating to infrastructure and lives. On top of that, at the beginning of my talk, I mentioned how Landis had kind of possibly regretted this because there were numerous infractions, both real and imagined, of the barnstorming rules that he was guarding. And it's, you know, theorized, and I believe it, that you know, the combination of the quote-unquote embarrassment of the Mita loss and these infractions of the barnstorming rules, combined with the, you know, devastation to Tokyo and the earthquake, prevented this idea of these regular major league tours. And over the course of the next several years, they just never picked up. You know, Hunter was probably the prime quote-unquote ambassador, but it really wasn't until 1931. Ty Cobb went in 1928, and as Rob mentioned, there were amateur tours, and in 1927, the Negro League Philadelphia Royal Giants toured, but in terms of major league teams, it wasn't until 1931 that there was another tour. There's the 31 tour, and then the 34 tour, and then obviously, like you said, World War II. Hi.
You had mentioned that they went to Korea. Did they play any games against Korean or Japanese teams?
They played a game against some local Korean teams. I don't have them off the top of my head, but I do have my paper here with me. They stayed at the Chosan Hotel in Seoul and played an all-Korean team at the South Manchurian Railway Grounds in Yongsan. And I believe that was they might have played two, but one or two games they played in Seoul before moving on and playing against the Shanghai Club and the Hong Kong Club in Shanghai, and then that's when they moved on to the Philippines and played several teams there. So no other questions, I'll turn it back over to Rob and we can keep on the questioning. Thank you.
Well, we really don't have any more business, so thank you for coming. But before I leave, is there any other questions you have about the committee, about the book? No? All right. Well, thanks for coming.